This is the Nichols-Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 17th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols-Patrick CPE. We're going to take a look at a number of developments that took place this week, as it seems that we have an accelerating number of developments here in the month of August. Congress may have left town, but the IRS and the courts have been busy giving us some new things to happen. And the first one we're going to talk about here is a case of the Financial Strategy Group, PLC, versus Continental Casualty Company. This is a Sixth Circuit decision affirming a lower court decision, docket number 146296, 2015 Tax Notes Today 152-16. This particular case involves a tax preparer who ran into trouble with his liability insurance. Why did he do that? In this case, two taxpayers became involved in a tax shelter that was promoted by a national accounting firm. They went to the accounting firm, they got the shelter set up. They basically got the national accounting firm to prepare the necessary tax returns for the first year of the arrangement. Now, probably not surprisingly, they may have discovered the national firm was going to charge a little bit more than, you know, they might be able to get from somebody else. So for the second and later years, they took the return back and took it back to this group, Financial Strategy Group, PLC. They prepared the 1065s and they prepared the individual tax returns related to this particular shelter. Now, what happens is eventually the IRS gets upset. The IRS comes in, assesses tax, penalties, interest, and the taxpayers begin suing everybody, and one of the people they sue is going to be this Financial Strategy Group who had prepared the 1065s and the 1040s for the second and following years. These guys figure they just had an arrangement to prepare tax returns. Their policy with their insurance carrier provided that that sort of compliance work generally was protected under the policy, except it would not basically, it said they would prepare against claims arising from tax preparation service and pay the claims, but the policy excluded claims based on arising out of or connection with the design, recommendation, referral, sale, or promotion of illegal tax shelters. The insurance carrier claimed this was related to an illegal tax shelter and therefore the exclusion of the policy said no coverage. The district court and the Sixth Circuit concluded that by preparing the tax returns and then preparing the underlying form 1065, preparing 1065 and the 1040, the tax preparer had effectively given an endorsement to the tax returns in question or to the positions in question. Having done so, it turned into a recommendation of the tax shelter. And both at the trial court and on appeal, they agreed the insurance carrier had no liability for paying this because of the illegal tax shelter exclusion. I suspect the preparer believed, as they argued in court, that we had just agreed to prepare the return. We didn't design this thing. But the problem is, the mere fact they hadn't designed it didn't mean that they somehow didn't have responsibility. They still had to review it, and the fact is, under professional standards, you're required to object to something like this if you decide that it doesn't really meet the requirements. So by preparing the 1065 and then preparing the 1040s based on the 1065 K-1s, they had effectively endorsed the arrangement. So despite the fact that they weren't the designer, and we have to presume they probably didn't get the fee for designing it, they still got stuck with liability for their share of what was deemed involved with having recommended this shelter, and they had no insurance coverage to protect them. Next up, we're going to talk about announcement 2015-22 issued by the IRS on August the 13th. In this announcement, the IRS held that, in fact, if there is data breach, if a person is a victim of data breach and they're provided with identity theft protection, the IRS will not treat that as taxable income to the victim of the breach. Companies that have data breaches often provide ID theft protection services. So if you've been involved, for instance, where your credit card may have been breached, because we've had a number of these where credit card or identity has been breached, if you've been involved in the Target situation, if you've been involved in a situation with some other retailers, if you've been involved in the Anthem situation, part of what you tend to get after all that's done and the data systems have been breached is they provide identity theft protection for a period of time for anybody whose identity may have been impacted by this. The IRS has said if you are in fact a victim of a data breach, if you're, we think you may have had data escape because somebody's data systems got breached, that's not going to be taxable income. But it is only true if it's due to a data breach. Now, it could be for an employee, it could be for a customer. But if it's not for those, right now the service says any other way you get that would conceivably be taxable income, although they did request comments on other situations where this identity theft protection might be provided, in which case maybe the service should provide additional guidance, which we would assume means that they're considering potentially not treating it as tax, treating it as taxable income in other situations. But for now, if you don't meet this requirement, it appears it looks like taxable income. Next up, we have the Ninth Circuit steps in on the Sophie case. This is a case of Charles Sophie versus Commissioner and Bruce Voss versus Commissioner, two related cases. Originally decided in 2012, 138 Tax Court No. 8 back in 2012, it was reversed by the Ninth Circuit, 116 AFTR 2nd, paragraph 2015, 5128. In this case, the question becomes, you had two unmarried individuals, they jointly owned a home. The question that arose was, we know there is a $1 million limitation on acquisition debt. The question to be decided was, if we have joint ownership of a home by an unmarried couple, do they each get $1 million? Because in this case, Mr. Sophie and Mr. Voss, the houses in question totaled just over $2 million. Or are they strictly limited to just $1 million on the homes? The tax court had decided this was a per residence limitation. So if you had joint ownership, then effectively we had $1 million total that could be done. The Ninth Circuit panel, in a 2-1 decision, split decision, held that in fact this was a per taxpayer limitation. Now, it was a split decision. The panel agreed that the law itself doesn't answer this question, and that opens up the door, to be quite honest, for the service to come back in and by regulation answer the question. And then under the decision that we had in the Mayo Clinic, the Mayo Foundation case, understanding that that's been kind of whittled away by Home Concrete and the case that dealt with the federal exchanges, the Supreme Court has kind of whittled away at what we thought Mayo gave us very clear guidance. But nevertheless, it would appear the IRS could write a reg to cover this. Secondly, because it was a 2-1 decision, and this is a reported tax court decision, outside the Ninth Circuit, it's still very iffy about how that's going to be treated. Because the tax court is still on record as saying it is a per-residence limitation. And certainly the service believes it is a per-residence limitation. So just be careful how you deal with this, but especially if you're in the Ninth Circuit, you may wish to consider filing claims for refund. If you're not in the Ninth Circuit, you may want to consider at least at a minimum a protective claim for refund. If you have taxpayers where you've limited it based on a per residence limit instead of a per taxpayer limit. In the case of Beck versus Commissioner, TC Memo 2015-149, we end up with yet another medical marijuana. Legal marijuana issue at the state level is producing a ton of cases. We haven't had this much telling us how Section 280 Cap E of the code works in ages, but we're suddenly getting a ton of these cases. In the case of Beck versus Commissioner, we looked at something brand new. Now, as you may recall, under Section 280 Cap E, if a taxpayer has a business that sells a federally controlled substance, which marijuana is, regardless of whether the state decides that that particular substance is legal to sell or not, under federal tax law, no deduction is allowed for anything except cost of sales. Well, in this case, the taxpayer had purchased marijuana, and the issue we're going to look at in here, because there's a couple of others in Beck, but I want to look at one in particular, was where the taxpayer had purchased the marijuana, normally that would be a cost of sales when it was sold, but there's this little problem that the Drug Enforcement Administration came in, raided the place, and took the marijuana. Now, the taxpayer claimed it was $600,000 worth of marijuana. The question we need to ask is, can he get a deduction? And the tax court in Memorandum Decision 2015-149 held a couple of things. First, it did note initially that his records were bad, so he couldn't prove the basis of that marijuana seized in any event or how much was actually seized. And so he wouldn't win there. But the court then said very openly, even if he had the records, it was not sold marijuana. Since that marijuana was not sold, it couldn't be deducted because it wasn't a cost of sale. And they also said, in case you're thinking maybe we could use Section 165 in the general loss rules to get the deduction for what the DEA took, The court found that 280 cap E would override those general loss rules under Section 165. So this seized marijuana is in essence non-deductible by the taxpayer because it must be a cost of marijuana sold, not a cost of marijuana that was seized, and we would presume not a cost of marijuana that may go bad, that may be unsaleable for some reason, you know, that's damaged. And none of that is apparently considered deductible. It's going to have to be sold marijuana. Again, we're getting a ton of these cases, and if you're in a state where legal marijuana sales exist, well, you know, we're going to see a few more of these come down. This particular case was under the law of California. Next up, Escalante versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2015-47. This is Tax Court Summary Opinion that came down. The taxpayer had taken time out from his teaching career, and he had gone in and spent a lot of time on his rental properties. And over the 3 years in question, 2005, 2006, 2007, in 2005, his official summary showed 4,000 hours in rental real estate. But he did admit that that was just hours he was available, and he claimed his actual hours were 2,540. He claimed that his hours in real estate in 2006 were 1,989 hours and 1,353 hours in 2007. He then said his teaching activities were 618 hours in 2005, 390 hours in 2006, and 932 hours in 2007. Mechanically, if you accept those numbers, he's going to be a real estate professional. Because what's going to happen in that case is he has more than 750 hours in real estate activities, and he had more hours in real estate activities than anything else. But this was a case where his records were simply found not to be believable. The problem in this case was, for the teaching hours, he didn't record his actual hours. He just took the straight 6 hours per day that was the minimum he had to work under the contract with the school district to be paid for each day. Considered no out-of-classroom time that was involved. Teachers generally have quite a bit of out-of-classroom time. None of that was counted. Secondly, he also had on his time for the real estate activities, the court found that a number of his claims were just didn't make sense. For instance, on average, he was claiming it took him 1 hour to write every check. Court said, basically, we don't have to ignore our real-world ideas, or you know, what we know in the real world, to say that that just isn't reasonable regardless of having a log. His log also had multiple days where he had more than 24 hours in a day. And the problem with that, of course, is, well, a log that turns up to more than 24 hours is kind of a problem. In fact, he has an exchange with the IRS attorney where he said on November 30th, 2007, you worked a 25-hour day on one of your rental properties. And the taxpayer's only response was, says, well, I guess it was a big day. Unfortunately, that just kind of told the court. The court said effectively, we simply can't rely on your records. Not relying on your records, you have not proven that you met the hourly amount. The burden's on you to prove it. So because of that, we're going to have to deny you as a real estate professional. Your losses therefore become automatically passive, and therefore we are going to disallow the deductions. You also got the taxpayer charged with a negligence penalty in this case. Next up, we have Final Regulations 9729. This was issued here. It deals with a transaction that was first described in Notice 2008-99 as a transaction of interest. In this particular case, it deals with an income beneficiary of a charitable remainder trust who sells off their entire interest in the trust. What would happen in this structure that was promoted as a tax shelter was that you would contribute assets that were highly appreciated to a charitable remainder trust. And when you do that, the donor gets a deduction for the present value of the future interest into that account. And, you know, then we get an income beneficiary who may be the original owner, may be somebody else. There's a general rule under the regulations under Section 6011 that basically says, when we get to that issue, that under 1001 E1, that says generally if you sell a term interest that's acquired by gift or transfer in trust from a decedent, the basis sold is reduced by any basis transferred under the gift or estate rule. So generally it's going to be all taxable gain. There is an exception to this under Section 1001 E3 that that rule does not apply if you dispose for your entire interest. The taxpayer here is disposing of their entire interest. The argument of the promoters of this said, well, what happens now is you look inside the trust. Now, remember, the trust sold the property at a gain. As a charitable remainder trust, it paid no tax on that gain. It just went into one of the layers that we're going to use to tax the distributions to the beneficiary in the future. But since the trust and the beneficiary now sell off all these newly acquired assets to a third party in exchange for their entire interest, now the taxpayer, the income beneficiary, has sold his entire interest. The claim being there, he gets the basis of the assets inside the CRT. Since the CRT already sold the low basis assets, replaced them with high basis assets, we essentially walk away and never have recognized the gain. Under the new regulations, if you do that situation, there's a special rule provided that in the case of a charitable remainder trust interest, you have to reduce your basis, the CRT, the basis of the assets in the trust, to the income beneficiary have to be reduced by any of those layers of unrecognized income. So basically, you have to take the basis of, so your share of the basis, because let's say 50% of the interest represent the income interest, so you'd get 50% of the basis, but we reduce that basis by the balance of undistributed ordinary income in the CRT and then the balance of undistributed capital gain, thus forcing you to recognize the income. Now, this rule applies to transactions basically occurring on or after January 6, 2014. It does not, the IRS says specifically that it says nothing about the treatment of those before that date, but also these cease to be transactions of interest, which is what they were defined as in 2008-99, which required disclosure on the tax return. Effectively, since there's no longer a tax shelter structure associated with this, the IRS no longer took that off the list of items for which we would have to have a disclosure on the tax return. Next up, IRS tax or TD 9730 and proposed regulations at Regulation 132075-14. The IRS is going to remove the automatic 30-day extension for information returns. For W-2s, it is going to happen. There are temporary regulations in 9730. We have final regulations. They remove things from the current regs. They put these temporaries in place. Plus, they put proposed regs that are the same as a temporary. For W-2s, in 2016 W-2s, the ones you'll file in January 2017, you will no longer be able to take an automatic 30-day extension. Under current law, if you file paper W-2s, they're due at the end of February. If you file electronically, they're due at the end of March. Current regulations allow you an automatic 30-day extension if you request it, and if we get to that in 30 days, you can request for cause a second 30-day extension. We're going to get rid of the automatic extension. For W-2s, it'll be the 2016 forms. For other information forms, it will be no earlier than the 2017 forms that will have to do this. You will have, as I said, an option for a single non-automatic 30-day extension. The IRS makes clear they do not expect to grant that very often. The idea being they want them in. Why is the service doing this? Because of identity theft. By rolling back the extensions, that's as far as the IRS can go in trying to get the information quicker to combat identity theft, because the dates for filing are set by Congress. But don't be surprised to see pressure come back on Congress to move those dates back. So if you file W-2s or you're filing information returns, as many of us are, you need to become aware that we're probably going to see a shortening of the dates for which those have to be filed. Certainly on your payrolls, you want to get ready in 2016 for the 2016 forms. If you've not been filing them by the February 28th date, you better get ready to be able to do so. Or if you're on electronic by March 31st, you need to get ready to file them by those dates. Because right now we're running quickly into a situation where to combat identity theft, there's going to be a lot of pressure to move those information returns up forward. Because when we have tax return-related identity theft, it almost always goes with falsified W-2s or other information returns that claim to have withholding, and that gets the whole process running. If the service had the information to compare against at the time those returns were filed, the theory is they could shut down the identity theft issues and would eliminate the incentive. Next up, Program Manager Technical Advice 2015-11. The IRS describes how to apply the Section 6662A penalty for when you fail to disclose a reportable transaction. That penalty on any understatement related to a reportable transaction rises from 20% to 30% if you don't disclose it. In this case, the taxpayer had a transaction that was failed to be disclosed. Under the rules applicable to these sorts of transactions, the IRS can catch up the stuff that had previously not been reported in the first open year. The question that arose was, could they, you know, were they forced to apply the penalty only to the part that affected the year in question, because this would have had reported income for a number of years before the year that they finally were to make the assessment, do the catch-up, or do they calculate everything in the current year? The technical advice, the program manager technical advice, concluded that the entire penalty applies in the current year because that's when it's recognized for the code, as well because the understatement is computed at the maximum individual rate, or the maximum tax rate applicable, that maximum rate would be the year in which the adjustment is made. You would not have to go back and go to the lower rates may have applied in years before 2012, or I should say, yeah, basically before 2013. You have to use the rates in the later years when you actually made the adjustment. The entire penalty applies based on that year's facts and only that year's facts. Finally, we're going to talk about something that we kind of noticed was going on. You may remember at the beginning of the year we had the Achieving a Better Life Experience Act of 2014, and one of the things that happened in that act was we created the Certified Professional Employer Organization position, where if you used a certified PEO and they failed to pay the payroll taxes, the employer would not be on the hook. Rather, the PEO would be on the hook for the unpaid taxes, which can be significant because we've had some really bad facts cases where that's happened, where a payroll, where somebody who was supposed to pay the payroll taxes for an employer that contracted that out turned out not to pay them. The law required the IRS to start taking applications by July 1st of this year and to essentially have the program running by January 1st of next year. On their website this week, the IRS announced that they weren't ready to start taking applications as of July 1st. Well, that's really no surprise because they didn't. July 1st came and went. We're now into August, and obviously they haven't been taking applications. They're going to start taking them July 1st of 2016. Now, while the announcement didn't say so, it would appear that that may very well mean that we're not going to get the protection of PEOs until the 2017 year instead of the 2016 year. That still remains to be discussed because, of course, Congress said you had to do it this year. The IRS is now saying, well, we just aren't ready to go. In any event, keep your eyes on what happens with the PEO, especially if you had a client that was planning to make use of the certified PEO rules. Let's say especially one who is using a larger organization that had already announced that they plan to meet those requirements. We'll just see what kind of relief, if any, the IRS offers into next year. And so keep your eyes open. My guess is they'll have to offer some sort of relief because it is the services, basically, fault that we don't have a way of getting protected for the first part of the year. May basically require us to do some sort of pre-certification by the organization stating that they qualify. That would be one option. And if you use such an organization, be protected. But for now, we just got to watch. That's something to keep an eye on as we go forward. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 17th, 2015. As always, this is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick. Be sure to visit us online at www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where we'll discuss, basically, we'll show you the links to all the materials we talked about today, plus articles describing all of these in much more detail. We'll also post developments during the coming week as they occur. Also, be sure to join us next week when we will once again talk about developments in federal taxes for the week in question.